just got called up to the big league, son. Welcome to the show. This is Primetime Sports with Bob McCowan on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Two for this Monday, October the 20th, 2014. It's a miserable day outside. People, fans are miserable. Everybody's miserable.
Really?
Might as well be miserable too.
I'm feeling okay. Why are you miserable?
I'm just people are miserable around me.
Really? Yeah, here? What, in this building?
A lot of misery going on here.
I know. Look, there's all the smiling faces on the other side of the glass.
What? Name one. Look at that. There's not a one.
Hey, look. They're waving at you. They're all happy.
Yeah, it's Jen.
They all have.
Jen's barely paying attention.
They're very happy in there.
Jim Houston will join us in a bit. Clint Malarchuk, who's a book out, will join us in studio. Rob Nyer of Fox Sports. And Don Lescherry will be with us. What's he going to say? Not enough good Ontario boys on the Leafs? That's why they're losing?
He might well say that. Don't wreck the segment, though.
Do you subscribe to that theory?
No, yeah, I think that's exactly why they are what they are. It has been a wild roller coaster 6-game ride, though. That's what I would say.
6-game ride.
We're down, we're up, we're down, we're throwing our jerseys back on the ice. Yes, indeed. And it's still October. The last time I looked, it's still October. Not to say they're going to become good, but it is October.
Well, I don't think, does anybody expect anything more than what you're getting? You know, you're getting, you know, some competitive games and the odd win here and there and the odd flash of optimism, but in the end, they are what they are.
Yeah, they're going to be kind of, you know, they'll be in it, but they are what they are, as you said. You know, it's.
I don't know if they'll be in it.
God, I heard some. I was listening to the Tim and Sid boys this afternoon, and there was, you know, they had our pal Mr. Cox on, and you know, the age old subject of, you know, why do people in Toronto take this? You know, the seats are, they still buy those if they stop buying those tickets, and I think, you know, the. Back in the day when Harold Ballard owned the team, when you had a crazy guy owning the team who for long stretches of his tenure refused to spend money, you know, when the economics of the NHL changed, when the WHA came along, he didn't keep guys. He didn't, you know, they lost their own guys to the WHA.
A lot of them.
And, you know, and he was a kook.
And key guys.
And key guys. And he was a kook and a destructive kook who would not spend the money. And therefore, you know, there's a pretty good correlation between that and the team being lousy. But now, you know, it's a cap league. They spend as much as they can. It's run by, we believe, you know, people who want to win. I don't think there's any kind of devious, you know, crazy person running the Leafs who doesn't really want to win or is doing it for their own kind of odd purposes. It's, you know, a corporate environment in which if they win, they will make more money.
Yeah, they would like to win. Make no mistake about it.
They really like to win.
Mm-hmm.
You know, probably more than the guy sitting in the seats because they'd be even more like Scrooge McDuck swimming in great buckets of money, right? There's a lot of obvious motivation here. If they won the Stanley Cup, many, many people, well, many shareholders, many whatever, would be richer than they are now. So that's pretty straightforward. They're not trying to win. And it's not because they're taking fans for granted that they are not winning. That's a double negative. But you know what I mean. You know, it has nothing to, they're not doing this to spite people. They want
so
to
do
win.
Do you have a theory on
well,
why?
Well, they haven't been very good at it. I have no theory aside from the fact they haven't been very good at it.
Well, here's the theory that I would suggest to you, that they want to win. There is pressure to win
mm-hmm.
with each passing minute, hour, day, week, month, and year, and decade of not winning. The pressures to win mount.
Yes.
And the ability to be patient declines.
Yeah, although patience isn't always, you know, they're pretty patient in Edmonton right now. It doesn't seem to be working, right?
No, I grant you that.
So it's
there are those out there that say, you know, like Pittsburgh did, like Chicago did, if not the only way to get out of an extended period of losing, one of the ways you can get out is by being bad enough for a period of time.
But Pittsburgh literally won the lottery. Literally won, you know, the ping pong ball to get Sidney Crosby. So
100%, right.
So that's dumb luck, right? It's the year you finish last.
No, but Kane and Taves are clearly the cornerstones of Chicago, and they are both drafted players.
No, I know. They've done it. And again, hats off to them, and they've done a great job. L.A. has done a tremendous job.
Right.
But, you know, everybody, we're pretty much on a level playing field except for the teams that can't or won't spend to the cap. So everybody, it is a level playing field. Everybody has the same, right. You know, and depending on where
but
you
what
finish.
What I'm getting to, though, Brent, is, I mean, just to look at Brian Burke, for example. You know, Burke had a plan to put it together slowly, to build it slowly. And then all of a sudden he thought he fell into something and ramped it up in a big hurry.
Well, he made a big deal, right? So you're talking about the Kessel
deal, well, but
deal,
before
right?
the Kessel deal, he thought he'd put together a defense that was, as he said to me, was as good as any in the National Hockey League.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people like the look of, on paper, you know, there were a lot of, you know, if you looked at the list of names, you would say, boy, they're, you know, but you had a guy, you had young players like Luke Shen who didn't go get better, you know?
No, you're right. You're right. But he thought at the time, because he had a rating system. I remember him telling me about this rating system, 6-5-4-3-2-1, and he had to have X number of points, you know, in that rating system. And he did the math on it, you know, sitting in my backyard and said, and we have this many points, and any other team with that many points wins games.
Yep.
And this was before he went and got Kessel. This was just before he went over to Sweden to try and get his, you know, lock up his young goaltender.
The monster, yeah.
Yeah, Gustafsson. Mm-hmm. You know, who didn't prove to be what he thought he was going to
although
be,
he's
too.
He's turned into a pretty, you know, a serviceable...
Serviceable backup.
Yep.
You know.
Maybe a little better than a lot of backups, I would say. But, yeah, he's not a superstar.
No. But he thought he had a goal... he thought his goaltending was good enough. And a chance to be really good. And he thought he had this blue-chip defense.
Yep.
And the only thing he was missing was some scoring punch. And so he went and did the deal for Kessel.
Yep.
And he didn't do it as a building block. He did it because he thought he'd put together... And this is before his first training camp. He thought he had a better team than he did. And, you know, if you look at the Leafs' history, you know, they went through this long period of acquiring guys that were 30-plus years of age that were on the downsides of their careers. You know, good players.
Well, that's because that's
very good players.
Because that's who you could get with money.
That's
remember,
who you could get.
You know, people forget this, but you weren't eligible for free agency until you were 32 years old.
But what it ultimately meant was the team was not horrible, but not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been kind of in that, you know, abyss, you know, and well, I don't pretend to know how to fix it, except that that's again what you have.
Yeah. You know, like the Kessel deal on the face of it. Again, if you still you can debate it all you want, but Phil Kessel's still an elite offensive player in the National Hockey League.
Yeah, I have no issue with that.
You know, who has essentially been that for the Toronto Maple Leafs. He's a little streaky, so that frustrates people, but if you put him on a good team that's winning, he's an incredibly important guy.
Kessel's place on the Toronto Maple Leafs is not the issue. Just take him out of the equation altogether. He's not the issue. The young players that they have brought in are not the issue because they are no worse, generally no better, but no worse than other young players elsewhere. It's the pieces in the middle. And the pieces in the middle are a tangible number. I never could understand valuing Dion Phaneuf at where they valued him. That didn't make any sense to me.
Well, but the whole point there is you get boxed in. You make the deal to bring him in as a number one guy, and that... as
you
your
have
number
to,
one defenseman.
But don't you have to be willing to walk away from that deal?
Well, then you got to find someone else to play his minutes and do what he does. And it's not like he's awful.
But wait, know? But you're
he's actually pretty darn good. But you're
asking, you know, you can't win with this group. At some point, you have to be able to say no enough.
But I don't know how that's
going to make... And they
don't. But I don't know how that's going to make you better. It's not like the money... You can't take the money you're going to spend on Dion Phaneuf and then go out and get, you know, a young Zdeno Chara, right? That guy's not there. So you end up paying the guy that you have, who is going to play a ton of minutes. You don't have anybody else to do that, and you may not be able to get anybody else to do that. So I'm not I don't You know, they were a little boxed in on that one, and I'm not. I think that was kind of the only sensible thing to do was to pay him.
Well,
at some point they may move on from him, but I think the only sensible thing at that point to do was to pay him.
I don't see it that way at all. I think what I see is I see an inability to win with Dion Phaneuf as your principal guy and your $8 million player.
Inability to win with a bunch for a bunch of reasons. You know, he's just an easy guy to point to.
Well, yeah, okay,
but there's not. It's not like you can switch him one for one for another guy who's going to – that guy isn't just sitting there saying, well, we'll get rid of Dion Phaneuf and we'll get, you know, Drew Doughty. You know, it's not going to work that
way. But nobody's saying that.
Well, who's going to play the minutes then? Who's your number one defenseman if it's not Dion Phaneuf on this team?
Well, maybe somebody evolves maybe they don't.
Well, someone's got to play those minutes.
Well, somebody else could play the minutes, and I'm not sure that the team would be that much inferior.
Oh.
We can continue this conversation. We
I'm sure we will with
Mr. Houston a little bit later on, or Mr. Cherry. We might be interested in your analysis of them. They will both join us later, as will Rob Nyer of Fox Sports. But joining us in studio, he's the author of a new book. It's called Saved, How I Survived My Life in Hockey. Clint Malarchuk joins us in studio. Nice to see you. How are you?
I'm awesome. It's good to be here.
It's a heck of a book, Clint. It's a I read it.
Oh, you did. Good.
And you know, you and Dan did a great job. It is as harrowing a sports book as I've ever read.
Wow.
I think it's very, very honest, and you know, hats off to you for being as honest as
you. Well, thank you. That means a lot. And it was a difficult difficult project all around, just because it was dealing with a lot of different things, and I just wanted to be open and honest. As much as I could, you know, and I think I did that part, but it's still tough. It's still tough dealing with this all now.
Yeah.
Are you in a place now where you can deal with this that you weren't perhaps previously?
I would say, yeah. I mean, I have to, obviously I take medication and, being diagnosed with several disorders, mental illness, it's something that I have to deal with, but I also have, a kind of a daily regimen that I have to follow as far as keeping my mind right.
Can you talk a little bit about, Clint, about having to deal with mental illness while being a professional athlete in an incredibly high, as high pressure a position as there is in sports, being a goaltender? That, this is something that goes back to childhood, right? This is you've been dealing with this your entire life. But within that context of playing in the National Hockey League, it must have been incredibly tough to keep the two things separate in some way.
Well, it's funny with obsessive compulsive disorder. It, in some ways, it was a blessing because it gave me a work ethic that I was so obsessed with working out and training and being the first on the ice and the last off. So in many ways, it was an attribute to your skills. You're trying to hone yourself and be the best you can. But on the other side, it's almost like, a lot of people with the recent passing of Robin Williams, his blessing of his just brilliant and comedic personality, the other spectrum is very depressive and, reclusive. And it became my curse as well. As it got worse, it overtook my life, really.
So you would train like compulsively, obsessively.
Absolutely.
That helped you become the player that you were.
For sure.
But in terms of your life, it made it impossible in a lot of ways, didn't it?
Yeah, and it's progressive. I think as time went on, it got worse and worse where, sure, it helped me work out and helped me, have a work ethic that, made me a competitor and made me a better player. But it overtook the more on the personal side of my life, away from the rink. I mean, that's when you're alone and you're left with your demons and it's hard to deal with them.
At what point were you diagnosed?
With obsessive compulsive disorder, I was diagnosed probably a couple years after the on-ice incident where I cut my jugular vein. And, probably trauma set that off. I look back on my life at that time. After the accident, within two and a half years, my life really did spiral downward.
What brought you to the diagnosis? How do you get from being this way? Did you recognize in yourself that you may have an issue?
Oh, I knew absolutely that something was wrong. But
sure.
Again, with mental illness, how do you come out? And really back, this is 1989, 1990, 91 in there. There wasn't a lot of exposure in the media or anything to these type of disorders.
Sure, of course.
So I was really going, what is wrong with me? I can't leave the house. You know, things were bothering me. If I was out in public, I was almost paranoid. Great actors. We are great actors. And, you know, I don't think a lot of people would see that in a person.
Did somebody lead you, though, Clint, to go and get help?
I talked to our team doctor, and he knew. I talked to him a little bit, you know, kind of saying, I'm not feeling right. Something is wrong. You know, I hit a point where I didn't sleep for about 10 days.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm not exaggerating. I mean, every time I closed my eyes, I just wake up with a startle as I start to drift off. And that was the telltale where, you know, you have complete exhaustion. My eyes were just constantly burning from lack of sleep.
Right.
That was way, that's way into your career, Clint. So,
oh yeah. I was in my 30s.
Yeah. So before that, you know, you're with, you know, you've got teammates, coaches, team doctors, you know, you're dealing with, you know, in that environment where, you know, you're around guys a lot of the time, where, you know, I'm just wondering, you know, how did you keep it from people successfully, or did people understand what in any sense there was something going on with you, or no?
Think I hit it very well, very well. You know, I was kind of like the locker room clown, and I think a lot of that acting out was to hide. Subconsciously, I'm a wreck on the inside, but outwardly I would, you know, just, and it was a relief for me to be around people and do that. I think it kept me busy. It kept my mind, kind of away from those thoughts and ruminations that were going through my head.
With Clint Malarchuk, the book is called Saved: How I Survived My Life in Hockey.
How do you get saved?
I don't know. That's what it says here.
Well, no.
Here, we get the real article for you, Bob.
Oh, great. Thank you. I don't know why it came out that way, but that's what I've got in front of me. It's called The Crazy Game, How I Survived in the Crease and Beyond. We weren't even close with that one.
But you look good for radio, so thanks. That's all that matters.
It is not unusual for someone with depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, anxiety, to head to a place where they feel more comfortable and where they feel less pain. And for many, it's drugs. For some, it's alcohol. Was it both for you, or was alcohol your choice?
Alcohol only. That's all I... And, you know, I'm very... I'm kind of a dinosaur when it comes to hockey. You know, I'm a traditionalist. I like the fighting. I don't think I should ever leave. You know, I got that... that kind of mentality. So for me, drugs was not something I even, you know, thought
sure.
about. You know, strictly alcohol.
Was part of it, but the reason you go to alcohol, because it is more ingrained in the culture of hockey too, and accepted.
Well, sure. You know,
beers. You're around it all the time.
Yeah, beers with the boys, and back when I first broke in the NHL, that, I mean, you know, there was no off-ice workouts, and, you know, we went for, you know, liquid lunch after practice, and it was, you know, it was the old school days.
But for you, it was in essence a drug. It was a way for you to cope.
It was self-medicating, for
right.
sure.
It's not, it had gone well beyond social.
Oh, yeah.
At what point did you realize the alcohol was a problem? Or did all these revelations kind of come at one time?
Well, I think at one point that there was definitely self-medicating, but I was still, you know, a very dedicated athlete and with the OCD. So it was kind of like, I can't drink, you know, I'm in training or, you know. So the alcohol became a factor later after I'd retired well into my retirement, and you know, things had, I actually got some great medication, saw a great doctor, and I was really doing good for about 12 years, and then I hit another bump in the road, and that is where I really started to hit the bottle more.
You tried to kill yourself, Clint, and you know, and that's, and
well, you don't want to sugarcoat it, do you?
Yeah, that's
it's in the book.
It's in the book.
Yeah,
and it's, you know, and again, it's one of those many things that you're very open about. Could you just talk a little bit about how you got to that point?
Yeah, I mean, at that point, I was feeling actually crazy. I really wasn't thinking straight. My depression was probably well beyond the clinical point.
Were you on meds?
Yeah, and that's another factor. I probably too late had gone to the doctor to get my meds adjusted because I really wasn't, I knew I wasn't in a good place. And it was, and the people around me could really tell that I was struggling terribly with things. And they got me to the doctor. And unfortunately, I was over-medicated. You know, when they took me on the Life Flight, they asked my wife, you know, what medication is he taking? And she brought out this, you know, like a suitcase. And they're saying, no, what's he taking now? And she goes, this is it. I mean, I was on a ton of antidepressants, and I'm not even sure what everything else was. But the combination with self-medicating with alcohol and all these medicines that I was taking, prescribed medicines, it was a bad deal.
I guess, you know, you could think of, you know, so you get to that incredible, horrible tipping point, and you know, live to tell the tale, and, you know, you say everything, then kind of things got better for you. But it's been a struggle since, hasn't it, Clint? Like, again, that's the book. It's not like it's over, you know, that.
Well, yeah, you know, and that's funny. The people that have read the book is just getting out now, but some media have had the chance to read it. And it's not a fairy tale, you know, and if they said if it was a novel, you'd just stay reading it because you don't know what this guy's going to do next.
Yeah.
And it's the way my life has been. And you're right. The ending is I'm doing great. You know, I'm obviously, you know, doing my program and taking the proper meds that I should and doing really good. But I did have a relapse not that long ago. And, you know, it was a bump in the road and nipped it in the bud. But, you know, it's a daily struggle for me to keep my thoughts in order and keep my emotions in check. And I have a great support group and I'm plugging through.
Yeah, because I can tell you, like, when I finished the book, Dan will tell you. You know, I went up to my first question for Dan after reading the book was, how's he doing now?
Yeah.
Because it felt like the ink was still wet, you know, in those last few pages there.
And you know, that was something that we discussed. Do we end the book in, you know, let's say February? And, well, we're missing a chapter. We'd be missing a chapter because a lot happened in March and April. And that's how recent this book is. It's right up to the spring. And we discussed it, and it was kind of left up to me. And I thought, well, you know what? We've been honest so far. If it's not hitting the printer yet, well, let's be honest right up until it hits the press.
What do you think when people read this in hockey, in the National Hockey League, people who've known you or know you,
right?
How do you think they're going to react?
You know, I have a lot of friends, you know, obviously in the game, and I was, you know, still in the NHL up to this starting this season. And, you know, I think a lot of them know me different than the players that I played with back in the 80s and early 90s. So, you know, my life has been fairly public. I don't think there's going to be, I think a lot of them go, wow, I didn't really realize how severe this was for Clint. But I think I'll be respected. And you know, it's obvious my intentions of the book, it's to help and inspire and give hope that people aren't alone with this and hopefully erase some of this mental illness stigma.
I know it's early days, but have you talked to, and I know probably a limited number of people have read the book now, mm-hmm. Have you talked to many of your former teammates, colleagues, people that you've known in your life in the game, and have they expressed like a shock, a surprise at what you went through because they never saw it in you?
Well, not really, because my two very close friends that are in the game, you know, like Rick Dudley, he's walked through these chapters with me in a lot of this book. I mean, you talk about a guy that's, you know, upper NHL in the executive area and was a former player and basically done it all. You talk about a man that was also a bit of a pugilist. I don't know if he'd like me saying that, but that's all right. He's a very compassionate man, and there's some others that, you know, have helped me along the way. You know, Scott Housen now in Edmonton, he was there. You know, I could list Steve Ledzik. You know, there's a lot of people that know me well that have gone through the dark days with me.
I'm sure, Clint, that the people who have known you have gone through the journey with you, mm-hmm. to some extent.
Yeah.
They've stayed in touch with you. They are aware,
right,
of what has happened in your life. I'm thinking more about players who maybe you've lost touch with.
Oh, yeah.
Who now are able to look back on it, maybe on your career and their relationship with you, and say, now that I see what he was going through, I understand some of the stuff that they couldn't have understood perhaps afterwards.
I think that'll come around. I think a lot of them will. But again, a lot of them are going to go, man, he seems so well-adjusted as a goalie. He was always joking around, and you could talk to him before a game. And, you know, outwardly, I was a pretty good actor.
You know, there's a... It is said in the game of hockey that goaltenders are a different breed anyway.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, you talk to anybody who's not a goaltender, and they'll always kind of give you, oh, he's a goaltender, and kind of roll their eyes. Yeah. And you've seen
it's an excuse, yeah.
Yeah, and for 99% of the guys, it's probably not true. It's just something that happens in the sport, just one of those things. I'm sure it happened to you, too. Guys thought, well, you're a goaltender, you're a little off-center.
Yeah, and I think nowadays it's a little different. The guys are more, you know, and that whether it's the sport or the position now, but, you know, it's not out there. But I think back in my era, and even definitely before the, you know, they started wearing masks and that, I think that the position attracted a certain breed. I mean, mm-hmm. to stand in front of a puck with no mask, you know.
You're pretty crazy.
Yeah, there's something there. It's a different man.
You know, you've talked about relapses. How do you deal with them? Do you recognize them? Are you able to recognize it, quickly?
Yes, I do now. I'm better. You know what? Life's an experience, and the more experience you get, the smarter you get. And sure. I think that, for me, you know, sometimes the learning curve is very sharp and has to be. And this last time, I think I learned a lot, you know, very much. I recognized I was going south. And I got the help, and I got it quick and got my feet under me. It was almost like going for a tune-up. And, you know, now I'm even smarter than I was from last time, sure. You know. And so one thing I do realize, this is a lifelong problem for me. And I don't want to think of it as a problem even. It's just something I have to do. There's certain things every day that I have to do besides taking my medicine. There's certain things I have to do to keep my thoughts in order and my emotions in check. And, acceptance is a big thing. I accept it. And if that's what it takes for me to be successful and function and hopefully down this road, to be out there and help other people, that's what I have to do. And I'll do it.
Do you think staying connected to the game, as you have,
mm-hmm.
Has been helpful? I don't want to say a crutch, but it's what you know.
I'm a hawk. It's in my blood.
Yeah.
And for sure, I think that if you're connected some way, it certainly is. It's what you grew up with. It's what you dreamed of. And then once you played in the NHL, and then you got the coach in the NHL, and it's your mentality. It's your makeup. It's such a big part of your life. I do have other passions that is also an outlet with me. I'm big into horses, mm-hmm. and you know. They're very therapeutic to me, and I'm an animal lover. So, you know, those things are important to me too.
Are you looking for another job in the game now? Is that part of the plan, Clint? Done?
You know, this project has been such a long and emotional process to do this book. I need to finish what we're doing and see where it leads me. You know, I loved coaching. I loved being around the players, and you know, in a form, you're a coach, but you're also, you know, kind of a mentor. Or, you know, I relate to what the goalies are going through. So, you know, it's not just what you do on the ice; it's off the ice as well, and what's going on through a goalie's head. And, you know, that to me is fun to help guys.
We wish you the best of luck with the book. As you may have gathered by the fact that I inaccurately portrayed the title, I hadn't seen it, the book, until just this moment. I look forward to reading it, though. The Crazy Game, How I Survived in the Crease and Beyond, by Clint Malarchuk. Thanks for being here today.
Oh, we thanks, guys. It. I appreciate it.
And the best of luck to you.
Yeah, thank best you. Of luck in general. Yeah.
Yeah. As I said.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like a cat. I've used a few lives. I gotta stay on track.
Yeah, you got a few left.
Yeah.
Jim Houston will join us in a bit. Primetime continues on the Sportsnet radio and television networks.
It's the only time you have control of Bob McCowan.
Let's go!
Subscribe to Primetime Sports Podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan, on demand. Ian Walker, tomorrow morning, 5:30 to 9. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Minutes before the hour, primetime continues on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Networks. McCowan and Brent, Rob Nyer of Fox Sports, and Don Cherry in the next hour of the program from the NHL on Sportsnet. Here's our pal Jim Houston. Hello, Jimmy. How are you? If Jimmy was there, we'd know. Hello, Jim.
Hello there.
Oh, there he is.
Yeah, we
love that. It was really good to hear Quinn Millarchuk on.
It's a heck of a story, Jim. I know you'll get a chance to read it at some point, but it is a tough one, I'll tell you.
Well, I know some of the story just from being around hockey rinks, but I can tell you I was one of the guys who was fooled. I was never really close friends with Clint because I was, you know, the Cub reporter, the guy who was, you know, coming in and out and doing broadcasting a lot of the games that he played in a few different places where he played, and really always enjoyed running into him because he was such an easy guy to talk to, always had a smile on his face, loved to talk about the game, and who knew what was going on behind that wonderful exterior that he put on. Didn't for the most part. As you know, as the years went on, we started to hear some stories about some different things that were going on. But as he put it to you guys, he was a wonderful actor, and I hope that he gets back in the game because there are some people that you meet within the sporting world that you just love to see at the rink or at the field or wherever the game is played. He's one of them that, you know, if you don't see him for 6 months and you run into him, you can shake hands and talk about anything. There was, you know, guys like the late Don Baisley was one of those, Al McNeil. I think of a whole bunch of people in my mind who I go through over the years that I always look forward to meeting them at the rink, and they'll always be a part of the game because the game means so much to them, and they are part of what we do on a daily basis within the game, and he's one of them.
Well said. Years ago, the Toronto-Montreal rivalry was such that you may argue that a Toronto fan or a Montreal fan would say, you know, we don't really, it's important to try and win the Stanley Cup, but as long as we're better than those guys. In other words, the Montreal fans wanted to be better. They wanted their team to be better than Toronto, and Toronto fans wanted their team to be better than Montreal. The same condition, I think, still exists in Alberta with Calgary and Edmonton, which must make being an Edmonton Oiler fan right now almost intolerable. Not only is your team not performing the way you'd hoped and not showing progress, really, but a Calgary team who, by their own admission, is finally in a rebuilding scenario, actually is playing well. What is the end game, in your opinion, in Edmonton?
Well, I take a step back, and I agree to a certain extent with what you're saying, but I think that those rivalries and the we got to do better than them, that sort of exists largely if you can make the playoffs. You know, it's if you've got two teams, one from, say, Toronto, one from Montreal, that are both capable of being in the playoffs and maybe both capable of making a run, then that rivalry is absolutely intense, whether they play each other in the playoffs or not. We got to be better than them. But I think some of that is lost when you have no hope of making the playoffs.
Mm.
Yeah, that's just a small victory to be able to beat the other team down the road when you're both going to miss the playoffs.
Okay.
The end game in Edmonton, I really appreciate what they did because you've heard me say before, we've talked about this and I have ad nauseum about the Canadian team's unwillingness to be bad enough to get good. And the Oilers were bad. And they let themselves bottom out, and they got the three first picks, and they got, you know, they did what you're supposed to do when you rebuild, which is get some really good players. They get Taylor Hall, who's a heck of a player, and the other guys are good players too, but they didn't get Sidney Crosby, and they didn't get Steven Stamkos or John Tavares. They got close with Taylor Hall. The other two guys that they got, Neil Yakupov, who knows what he's going to be like, and Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, I hope he can stay in the lineup because he is a really good player, but he's a pretty small guy playing a really difficult position. The end game for them is to get better and make the playoffs, but they've now got to get that supporting cast to be better. And I think they did some of that in the summer. We haven't seen the fruit of what they've done in the summer yet. I kind of think it's going to be better. I don't think they're a playoff team. I think they're a heck of a lot better than the way they played. And I think when Craig Ramsey, who's there, gets his hands on that defense for a while, they're going to be better. They got to be able to check a little bit. And they got to be able to stay close in a game, which they did against Vancouver the other night. This is a tough, tough homestand for them, because everything they're doing is brought to bear in front of their fans, who have been too long suffering, and they better do something in this homestand, or they may have to do something just to please the fans who want somebody to pay for this. But I really do think they're better than what they've shown early in the season. They got to get better goaltending, and they got to be able to check.
Jimmy, I want to ask you a little bit about your hometown team. The sellout streak has been broken, which is interesting. You know, in Toronto, they endlessly talk about what if people didn't show up, if they didn't fill the rink every night. Well, in Vancouver, they're not filling the rink every night. But, you know, that's a hangover from the bleak, horrible season last year and all the discontent. There is, you know, light glimmering on the horizon right now. But, you know, you have their damage was done, right? So what's the mood of the place right now around the Canucks?
I would say that just my anecdotal sense of what's going on around the city from people that I hang out with and talk to is that it's hopeful again, and that there is reason to think that you know, I don't think that anybody is blind to what's going on there. I don't think they see them as a Stanley Cup contender, but they might be a playoff contender again. And what I think people are happy about is the excitement might be coming back, because they were a fun team to watch for a lot of years. Even before Alain Vigneault took over, you may recall before the first of the long lockouts, they were the best team in the National Hockey League, in my opinion, but they didn't win the Stanley Cup. They played the game the right way, the way people wanted to watch it under Mark Crawford, with players like Marcus Naslund and Brendan Morrison and Todd Bertuzzi and Ed Jovanovski. So people got really used to an exciting brand of hockey. And then the Sedins took over the team and Vigneault took over the team, and they built towards 2011. And it was a happening place. You wanted to be at the Canuck games, whether they won or lost, and they won most of them. They were fun to watch. It was exciting. And then even before last year, which was an unmitigated disaster, even before that, 2011-12, the hangover season from the Stanley Cup, the games weren't very exciting. They were hanging on and winning 2-1. They were playing so defensively that the rink was quiet. It was just not an awful lot of fun to watch them play. And the early returns, and they are really early, is that they're going to play an exciting enough game to get people back into the rink and buying season tickets, because they don't, you know, in Vancouver, they're not like an awful lot of other cities. There's so many things going on, I guess, for people to do that when they get mad, they just go away, and they will. And so they've done pretty well with the things they did over the summer with Trevor Linden coming back and some change that had to be made to hang on to some season ticket holders that they saw leaving in flocks. And now the first of the early returns are that the games are going to be fun to watch. And if that's the case, they'll pack the place again.
Because they used to have, they had a Toronto-like waiting list for season tickets at one point, didn't they?
They did, and they still contend. They still say they have a waiting list, but a lot of the people on the waiting list chose not to have their number called and let people go around them and get the season tickets.
Wow.
So, yeah. So whether that constitutes a real waiting list or not, I don't know.
How much of this, I mean, they made change during the course of the offseason. Significant change in goal, but change in goal has been a pattern for the last few months for the Vancouver Canucks in a variety of ways. How much of this is change on the ice? How much of this is pure change the coach, change the approach?
Yeah, well, I think both. I think the approach and the cloud had to be lifted off the ice. It was really clear that it just wasn't going in the right direction, and they needed change. They weren't making the right changes. There was a negativity. There was such an air of negativity around the team, not only from the way they played the game, which was not fun to watch, but even just watching what was going on in the organization and the way that people were dealing with each other and the quotes and the press conferences and all of that stuff.
John Tortorella negative? Is that what you're saying, Jim? I just can't believe that. That doesn't sound like him at all.
it was just there was like there's a black cloud that hangs over Vancouver from the 1st of November till the end of March anyway.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, when it's raining for 6 months, you don't need to have more of that, which in the place that is supposed to be your fun outlet. And the fun meter didn't get close to the red line for a couple of years there. So they had to make change off the ice. And clearly, I think that the ownership realized that their waiting list was going to keep waiting for a long time before they bought the tickets. So they better make some change. And Trevor Linden, he can do no wrong. And in the community, he's beloved by everyone, but more than that, he's got some substance to him as well. So they brought him in, and that was a really good move. And the players, to their credit, and you, Stephen, were just over in Schelvinkst,
yep,
and got a really close up look and heard about what the Sedins are like. And what those players like, and Marcus Naslin shares this attribute, and so did Peter Forsberg, and the Sedins are like this. They won't blame anybody. They took on all the blame themselves. It was our fault. It wasn't John Tortorella. It wasn't Mike Gillis. It had nothing to do with it. It was us. And everybody knows that that's not the case, but they refuse to blame anybody, and now look at them play again. They look like they're reborn.
They do, you know. And I was going to say, Jim, how much of this boils down to as go the Sedins, so go the Canucks? That's a huge part of it, right?
Well, there's some of that. There's some of that. I mean, in every team, you see with the Toronto Maple Leafs, when the top line doesn't play very well, they don't usually get great results. So you need your very good players to lead you along. But it is a team game. And I think, you know, they were at a point where there were three guys every night that were sitting on the bench that didn't play. And how good can that be for the morale of the team? And when the top guys are getting tired and you've got three guys who would love to get out there and give them a hand, but they're not allowed off the bench. And so you have to have everybody coming together as a team, and they have to know where they stand. And there was guys who would never even talk to the coach and didn't know where their position was with the team. They were perplexed. And so, you know, it was a bit of a mess. And, team always trumps individual in hockey and all team sports. And if you can build a team and get your guys to play together, you can oftentimes beat the team that has some better players. But you can't do it if you've just got a few guys and a whole bunch of guys who have checked out. And they had a lot of guys who had checked out.
Are there pieces still missing in Vancouver?
Oh, yeah. Their young guys aren't quite as good as they had hoped and aren't quite ready. Their Utica team should be pretty good. And people will watch them with interest to see if Hunter Shinkarik can become a player, because he's a scorer, and they desperately need that. I don't think Bo Horvat is going to stick around. I think he'll end up probably going back to London, although that's a bit of a dilemma. They'd love to be able to send him to the American Hockey League.
Right.
And Nick Jensen is a player. They've got a couple of, Frank Corrado is a defenseman. They do have some pieces in the organization, and I would say this, Toronto's a bit like that as well. There are some guys, but they're not quite ready yet, so you're left in limbo, and you can hope. You got to hope in Vancouver that the Sedins have a couple of three good years left and then can be supplemented by some really good young players and pushed aside. Just as when Henrik and Daniel Sedin started with the Vancouver Canucks, they were second and third line guys. And they finally had to push Marcus Naslin and Todd Bertuzzi and Brendan Morrison aside before they became first line players. And what the Vancouver team needs now is somebody to push those guys out of the way and relegate them to, you know, 16 minutes a night,
right,
take their ice time away, and the team gets better because of it.
Mr. Houston, always a pleasure. Thanks very much, and we'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Okay, see you later, guys.
Jim Houston of the NHL on Sportsnet. More hockey when we come back. Don Cherry will join us of Coach's Corner.
Later. Oh, that Don Cherry, not the other one.
Not the other one. Not the lounge singer. Not so many weeks ago, Mr. Cherry opined that one of the problems with the Toronto Maple Leafs, maybe the only problem with the Toronto Maple Leafs, is they continuously have refused to draft Ontario-born hockey players. Is that at the core of the Leafs' dilemma? See if Mr. Cherry wants to expound on that. And the World Series is right around the corner. Rob Nyer of Fox Sports talks about that coming up on Primetime.